Hello, and welcome to our webinar today, Exploring Liquidity Risk. In this webinar, we're going to start with some very basic principles of liquidity risk and move on from there. Webinar is going to be about an hour, and we do encourage your questions. You can type your questions in the box there on the on your screen. Those questions don't show up out there. They only come to us, and we'll try and respond to them in a timely manner. We have a lot of stuff to cover today, so I'm just gonna move forward with the presentation. Focus today will be a liquidity risk, and for credit unions, that mainly is an analysis of your balance sheet. For credit unions, most of your liquidity risk is in your balance sheet, and we're going to talk about some ratios which would identify liquidity risk, forecasted cash flows, some stress testing, and then we're going to end up with a couple of slides about liquidity policy and a contingency funding plan. Probably everyone here knows what liquidity is. Basically, it's when you don't have any money. If you have enough money to pay your bills and meet your share withdrawals and meet all the commitments you've made to your counterparties, you're liquid. If you don't, then liquidity risk has landed at your place, and you have that potential that you don't have the funding or the funds to meet all the demands for cash or cash equivalents that you have there. For the moment at least, the liquidity risk is not high for the majority of credit unions out there. There's low demand, short-term investments, money's flowed into the system over the last few years, and almost all of you are very liquid. But let's not make the mistake of assuming that because something is okay for now that it won't change. Here's why. Assets tend to be longer lived and more complex than they used to be. We believe the deposits are more volatile, especially the deposits that have flowed into the credit union system in the last few years. They seem to have come in regardless of the rate. We don't know that they are rate sensitive or not rate sensitive, or what the members' plans would be for them. So we're classifying them as possibly volatile. Capital may not be as strong as we thought it was, although we've recovered from that to a large extent. Your members are better informed, are more sophisticated, and more demanding. And in the case of liquidity risk, perception is reality, regardless of whether it's right or wrong. If your members perceive that the credit union has a problem, then it has a problem. In an age of Facebook and emails and text messaging, news travels very fast, especially if it's bad news. So while you may not have a liquidity risk issue today, most of you don't make the mistake of thinking that you couldn't have. And the last thing I would mention here before we go on to the next slide is think about where you would like your balance sheet to be. For the majority of you, your balance sheet is not where you would like it to be. You would like to have a lot more loans on the books. And if you should get your wish, then liquidity risk will have an impact on your strategic planning and that type of thing. So I'm not saying don't wish for more loans. We understand that's what credit unions do, but if you get your wish, then you're going to have to work a little bit harder at managing liquidity risk. Here's where liquidity risk comes from for credit unions. First one is the balance sheet mismatch, intermediate and long-term assets funded with short-term liabilities, unbalanced growth, demand for loans could outpace deposit growth. It hasn't in recent years, I understand that, but it could. There's field of membership issues. Credit unions are concentrators of risk within its field of membership, and if there's an impact on your field of membership that requires cash or funding, that will affect the credit union. There's always the issue of systemic risk and the issue of reputation risk, and the confidence of your counterparties is crucial. Most of your counterparties are your members, and so their confidence is crucial. Here's what you have going for you at the credit union. There are some unique attributes at the credit union that really have a very calming impact on liquidity risk. And that the main one is that your funding, almost all of your funds, are provided by insured retail deposits. And the operative word there is insured retail deposits, because insured retail deposits are by and large very stable. Even if there's a reputation risk issue, the insured retail deposits aren't going to all want to get up and leave on the same day, at least if history is any indicator of how that would happen. Insured retail deposits typically are very stable. Your member owned, that counts for something. Your pattern of cash flow is a little bit shielded from external events. Direct deposits, for example, keep coming in. It takes a significant effort on the part of your members to change their direct deposits. And installment loans provide a real hedge against the liquidity risk. Interest is paid every month. Principal pays each month unless the loan is delinquent. And typically your loan portfolio rolls over about every 30 months, but you just have that cash flow of loan interest being paid regularly, principal being paid on loans regularly, and that just provides a really calming effect to the issues of liquidity risk. So that's some of the unique advantages that credit unions have. There are some disadvantages, and one of those we mentioned already is the concentration of risks. Your field of membership, the geographic concentrations, the demographic concentrations. So credit unions are small compared to the world at large and the large banking institutions. All credit unions are small, and almost all of you fit in that category. Even if you're a $200 or $300 or $400 million credit union, when you look at the size of some of your competitors out there, it's a very small asset base to work off of. Reputation risk, again, can be impacted by that concentration, and credit unions typically are small when compared to the world at large. And for most of you, you're not active in the capital markets and don't have a lot of experience in the capital markets, and that's a little bit of a disadvantage. If a very large bank has a liquidity issue, they'll probably just go to the capital markets and raise funding in the capital markets through a number of resources. Credit unions typically don't have the sophistication and the experience to do that. So where does the demand for funding, or where does liquidity risk come from? First of all, if you owe money to a wholesale lender like your corporate or the Federal Home Loan Bank or the Fed discount window, that has to be paid. Typically those are demand loans, in some cases not, but if you owe a loan and the terms say that you need to make a payment, then you need to make a payment. That's a demand for funding. The majority of the demand for funding comes from member deposits. There's various classes of member deposits. We've already talked that insured shares and deposits tend to be very stable, but even if 5% of those left, that could be a significant unanticipated outflow of funds. Uninsured depositors are less stable. Business deposits are less stable. Single relationship CDs, that's where the member's only relationship with the credit union is through a CD, probably based on rate or price. And large depositors tend to be a little bit more unstable. Your non-member deposits, brokered funds, and public funds tend to be not nearly as stable as your insured in your insured shares. So there's kind of where the sources of funding demand from your counterparties originates. The big one from the standpoint of the largest number is your insured shares. That's the least likely to happen, but if it does happen, you've got almost all of your funding comes from insured shares. So a minor hiccup there could cause relationships. Some of you have single relationship CDs. A few of you have brokered CDs, and a handful of you have public funds, and those are the areas that you want to be careful of. Additionally, you don't want to cut off new loans. The credit union wants to be in a position where if a qualified borrower walks in, you are going to want to make that loan. You don't want a lifelong member or a really strong member to walk in and say, hey, I want to buy a new pickup truck. In fact, I just bought it. When can I get my check? You say, well, yeah, you are a great borrower. Your loan's approved, but we won't have the money for a few days. That would be something that you obviously want to avoid, injuring that business relationship. So even though technically you don't have to make new loans, you certainly don't want to be in a position where you turn down good loans. The other issue that we need to talk about is off-balance sheet items. For credit unions, they typically are minimized, but if you have lines of credit that you've issued for credit cards or home equity lines of credit or maybe business lines of credit, you need to be ready to fund those things. If you by any chance sold any loans with recourse, if you're involved in derivatives and hedging, which probably the majority are not, probably all of you are not at this point in time. In the future, that could change. So there's your demand for funding. Now, where do we obtain the funding? Where does the funding come from? Most of it is going to come from your balance sheet, either on your assets or adding to your shares and deposits. Maturing investments. When we do the cash flow statement, you'll see that we're looking primarily at maturing investments to fund liquidity demand. Loan turnover or maturing loans. Your installment loans mature a little bit every month. Retail shares and deposits. Even if there's a reputation risk issue for insured deposits, there is the definite possibility that you could have a CD sale or a CD special and raise additional funding. Brokered deposits, it's literally a matter of less than a day to get set up to take brokered deposits over the internet. Not under the best of circumstances, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about if you need money, where are you going to get it? Investment sales, your investments, some of them have market values and can be sold. Loan sales is a little bit more problematical, but theoretically loans can be sold, mortgage loans especially, and if you're doing this, then that's a bona fide source of funding. If you've never done it, then probably not anything you want to rely on. Loans are committed lines of credit on pledged assets. This would be the Federal Home Loan Bank, or possibly at the corporate. Possibly at the Federal Reserve discount window. I didn't get that one listed there. Or the Central Liquidity Facility, which most of you are never going to belong to unless the rules change. And then unsecured lines of credit. This would be the line of credit that most of you have with your corporate, where it's a daily demand type of loan, which is way down the list on things that you want to rely on. Let's talk a little bit about where the regulators enter in. Liquidity was the primary cause of the crunch in 2008, not with credit unions, but with the large banks. They basically, their funding sources dried up, and they basically ran out of liquidity. The banking system very nearly collapsed because of the lack of liquidity. Basically, we got to where that perception is reality, and everybody perceived that nobody was trustworthy, so nobody would extend credit to anybody. And I'm talking about among the large major banks. And the system basically just froze up. And as a result of that, we've had a lot of rules and regulations come down with liquidity. The primary one being the FFIEC guidance issued in March of 2010. NCOA is part of the FFIEC, and what that guidance requires is a system to manage liquidity that's commensurate with your complexity and your risk profile. You need a cushion of liquid assets, but they don't say how much. You need cash flow projections. You need stress testing. You need diversified funding sources. And you need a contingency funding plan. Now, it took the National Credit Union Administration, so this applies to almost all credit unions except those that are privately insured through ASI, and there may be some of you out there. Technically, this doesn't apply, but in reality, your state regulators are still going to apply it and apply the spirit of the law. So it took NCUA 3 years to actually work through that official document from the FFIEC and outline to credit unions what was expected of them. Because there is that paragraph, that bullet in there about consistent with the complexity of your institution. So here's NCUA and their take on this for federally insured credit unions, not just federal credit unions, but all federally insured credit unions. If you're under $50 million in total assets, you're required to maintain a liquidity policy written, which outlines the framework for managing liquidity and identifies contingent liquidity sources. And then on top of that, it goes without saying you're required to use common sense and good business practices. So if you're under $50 million, you're in compliance with the rule by having a written liquidity policy approved and meeting these requirements. If the credit union's total assets exceed $50 million, so if you're at $40 million and rising, this is going to apply to you either now or in the future, you are required to have a contingency funding plan. This is a plan, and it goes without saying that it's in writing, that sets out strategies for managing funding shortfalls and emergencies. I've been talking to people about this for about 6 months now. A lot of people that I've spoken with personally don't understand that this has to be a written document that sets out your plan for managing shortfalls. When I speak with people, they say, well, we just completed a line of credit with our corporate or with some other third party, and they're confident that meets the requirement, and honestly, I don't believe it does. If that's part of your contingency funding plan that's written, and we're going to talk about the components of a contingency funding plan here in a minute, then that's part of the compliance. But basically, you need to have a funding plan, a plan that says out in general terms, not specific terms, what you're going to do if you have a funding shortfall. And then if you happen to be over $250 million in assets, you are required to access one of the federal liquidity sources. There are two, the Fed discount window or the central liquidity facility, and test that periodically. And there are probably a few of you out there that meet this requirement. And this is fairly easy to do with the Fed discount window. It doesn't cost you anything other than some time to fill out documents and meet their requirements. There's no fees attached or anything. The Fed discount window is a very short-term lender, usually for a few days or a few weeks at the very most. The CLF is very problematical to access at this point in time. So that's the basic requirements. Most of you probably fall in this 50 to 2 million 250 category. It means that you need to have a contingency funding plan. We're going to come back and talk about that in just a few minutes. Let's talk about how we estimate liquidity risk. Before we do that, however, the classic way to estimate liquidity risk is static balance sheet ratios. Let's start at the bottom here rather than at the top. Total loans to total assets and total shares to total assets. These are ratios that almost all of you calculate. especially this one. This is the most common right here, shares to total assets. And these are bona fide liquidity ratios. In other words, if your shares to total assets or your shares, let's talk about shares, loans to shares, for example. If your loans to share ratio gets to 90%, that might be a trigger. Your contingency funding plan, it's, part of that is identifying triggers. This could be one of the triggers. If our shares, loans to shares gets to 90% or whatever number you choose, I'm not throwing out suggestions here, then that would trigger your contingency funding plan. But these are very, very traditional ratios. Now let's go back up to the top. This is overnight cash ratio. This is cash and cash equivalents to total assets. Another ratio that's very common. Another ratio very common is your 1 year liquidity ratio. And I believe NCUA calls this short-term liquidity ratio. This is cash and overnight and cash equivalents plus investments that mature within a year or less to total assets. So that could be a trigger. Your overnight cash ratio could be a trigger. A combination of these things could be a trigger to trigger your contingency funding plan or just to measure or estimate your liquidity risk. And these are ratios that probably all of you are familiar with and have used to estimate liquidity risk. The last one here, periodic loan turnover, that's just the speed at which your loan portfolio turns over, and it simply measures, estimates that, and if that speed is increasing, if your loans are turning over more quickly, obviously that is a positive sign from the standpoint of liquidity, might be a negative sign from the standpoint of loan production, however. So these five ratios are the traditional ratios, and there's others. There, NCUA has a bunch. There's others. You can probably list 20 or 30 ratios that you can pull out of your balance sheet that would assist you in measuring and estimating liquidity risk. However, they represent a point in time and in the past and don't necessarily measure looking forward, and that's what we need to do when we're estimating liquidity risk, is to be looking forward. So the most common way to estimate liquidity risk is a cash flow forecast, where we actually determine or estimate the money that's going to come into the credit union, the money that's going to leave the credit union in a future period, and then look, figure a net. And most of us work on the net. Here's kind of the steps. You need to start somewhere. Usually you would start with a recent quarter close or monthly close. Determine what period you're going to cover. The most critical period is the first 30 days. Some large institutions do daily cash flow. Some do intraday cash flow. For most of you, probably monthly cash flow will cover most of your needs. You need to estimate the cash going in and out of the credit union and convert that impact on your cash flow. So you need, we're talking about things like, are loans going to increase or decrease? What is loan demand going to be like? Are we going to make more loans than we then pay off? Or are we going to see our loan portfolio contract? We need to consider commitments we've made off the balance sheet, if those are called on us. And we suggest that you look at your investment portfolio as the way that you're going to cover cash flow shortfalls. So, cash flow statements or estimates are not rocket science. They're something that's taught in every, or I can't say that because I'm not familiar with them, but almost all university-level accounting programs teach cash flow statements, both historical and future cash flow forecasts. It's not nearly as complex as estimating interest rate risk, for example. It's something that you can do yourself if you are an accountant or a finance person. Estimating cash flows in the future is relatively straightforward. You can do it on a spreadsheet like Excel or whatever spreadsheet suits your fancy. And there's just a couple of simple principles that we need to learn. The first one is when you make a loan, cash goes out. That makes all the sense in the world. When you make a loan, you're going to have to give cash to the borrower. Member comes in, borrows $50,000 for a new pickup truck. You're going to see $50,000 going out of the credit union. If that member comes back later on and repays that loan and the balance is, say, down to 40, the member's going to give you cash. So when loans are paid off, cash comes in. And typically cash going out is in red with brackets around it, or at least with brackets around it. And cash coming in has no brackets. So positive cash flow, and the example I'm going to show you, is black with no brackets. Negative cash flow is red with brackets around it. You can do it any way you want. We have exactly the opposite impact with shares. When a member makes a deposit, cash comes in, no brackets, a member comes in, deposits $10,000 into their money market account, there's $10,000 that you can now do something with, either make an investment or make a loan. But when members withdraw, that's a demand on your cash, a demand, and that type of thing. So member withdrawals are cash going out, so they're bracketed with usually in red in the case of our example. When members deposit, then that's a positive cash flow. And so basically, if we have a loan balance of $111,141,000, estimated net monthly change on a cash basis could be -$226,000. And the question is, did loans increase or decrease? And in this case, loans increased. Loans increased from 331 of that year until now, because cash net loans went out the door. And we had a net cash outflow of loans. That means that the loan had increased during that period of time. You made more loans than paid off. It's kind of problematical to grasp, but if you think through it from the basics, it usually comes. So here's an example of a cash flow analysis. It's in two parts. The first part is the operations side of the credit union. Let me get my pen here. We're going to go through this. We have lending activities and we have deposit activities, and I've highlighted them and called these the operational aspects of your cash flow statement, because that's what the credit union does. You take in deposits and make loans. And that's your basic activity, is providing deposit opportunities for your members and taking that money and making loans with it. So as to how you break these down by shares and loans, that's up to you. I would start with very large groups, maybe total loans, and say, well, are loans going to increase or decreasing over the next 30 days? Or you can break it down. In this case, we've broken it down into five different groups of loans. So you're going to have to make an estimate about the activities in those loan accounts. Same with deposits and shares. We've broken it down into kind of a traditional matrix of shares, checking, money markets, CDs, and that type of thing. This is just an example. You can do this any way you want. I've seen cash flow statements that are very detailed, and I've seen those that are very consolidated, which is loans, or maybe consumer loans and mortgage loans. After you make that decision, obviously you have to start someplace, as we mentioned. So in this case, the date was June 30th of 10. You can tell I've been using this example for a while. Now, next column, and this is just an Excel spreadsheet, we have to decide how we're going to estimate the growth of growth or lack of growth in each of these components in our balance sheet. If it's something that can be boiled down to a formula that we can write into Excel, that's great. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. The first impulse is to look at historical activities and say, hey, you know, we grew 10% last year, so we'll just assume we're going to grow 10% this year. Very, very common mistake. In this case right here, we're saying the 2.5%, we're saying that the annualized growth of new car loans is going to be 2.5%. Then we can write that formula in here and actually have the spreadsheet work it out. This is loan growth, so negative numbers, right? Loans are growing, cash is going out the door. More cash is going out that's coming in. Next column down, we have zero. This means cash going out is going to equal cash coming in. We're not growing the loans, but they're not running off either. We have loans paying off when we're lending out the loans. We're lending out and replacing the loans that are being paid off. But it's a negative impact, or it's a zero or neutral impact on our balance sheet or on our forecasted cash flows. And now, all of these, in this case, I should have made an example of one of these. Sometimes you can't write a formula. For example, if you're an agricultural credit union, some of you are, you may see loan growth go way up in the spring and loan repayments come way back in the fall. And you're just going to have to do that manually. There's just no way to do it. You can look at historical patterns in the past if you want to, but in the end, you just may have to fill in some of these cells over here. Now, what's the very most important component here? And I'm just going to tell you right off the hand, it's the first 30 days. In this case, the month of July is the most important part of this, 30 days. The reason 30 days is most important is liquidity events tend to be fairly short-lived. And if you can get through the first 30 days, you're probably going to be able to figure something out and live, is what it boils down to. So even though this goes out for a full year, the most important period is the first 30 days. Down here, off to the lower left-hand corner of the screen here, we net cash flows from off-balance sheet items. These could be in the credit union world, lines of credit, home equity lines. Now, I put in a negative $1 million here. Could be a number of things. I just wanted to illustrate that if you have off-balance sheet potential demands for funding, it could show up someday. And you can see that has a pretty good impact here. And so the bottom line here is net cash flow from operations. And you can see here that we've got a negative cash flow from lending and a negative cash flow from deposits as well. Deposits are running off a little bit. Lending is expanding a little bit. So we have a net negative cash flow in the first period. We have a net negative cash flow of $737. And for the year, we have a net negative cash flow over here in the lower right-hand corner, $9.8 million. Okay. I loaded this up to illustrate a negative cash flow. I realize this isn't typical, but I had to illustrate a negative cash flow because credit unions are so liquid right now that if I didn't do this, it would just be a totally meaningless exercise. So that is the operations part of the cash flow statement. The credit union makes loans, and it makes those loans with deposits. And so we've calculated our net cash flow from operations. So let's go on to the next page. Okay, now we have that net cash flow from operations carrying down. This is the next page. There's that number. Now, remember I said earlier that we were going to take the investment portfolio and use that as our primary funding source for shortfalls. Well, we've got a pretty good shortfall here, $737,000 the first 3 months. Then we hit that month right here where we have that off-balance sheet number. So we got $9.8 million for the year. Our investment portfolio, we have overnight cash of 5.2. Investment certificates, we have 3 million, but only 100,000 matures in the next 30 days. And then we have mortgage-backed securities that aren't maturing at all. And these are pretty odd mortgage-backed securities because there's no cash, there's no principal being paid back at this point in time. So I need to make some adjustments on this this example. But in the end, we have in month one $5.3 million of available cash to cover less than a million, about 0.73 million. So we're doing really good. We have cover all that. We got 4.8 million left over. And we're going to assume that that stays in short-term deposits. If during that first month you take this money up here and start making longer-term investments, you're going to have to redo your cash flow statement. It's okay if you do that, but just recognize this assumption on this cash flow statement is that the short-term funding will stay in place as you use it up. So basically, the next month in August, we have another negative $637,000. I was wrong up here. It's not a negative. We have it's a negative $737,000 up here, and we have $100,000, so that's out of $637,000. But we still here. We're living off of that short-term overnight cash account. Okay, when we get over to here, mid-page, we're down to $656,000 in funding. Now, the purpose, one of the purposes of this cash flow, and let me get rid of some of these scribbles here, is that we identify this here in time to do something about it. We don't want to get here, right here, and be looking at here and here. I mean, holy cow, we got a problem coming up. We want to identify that problem clear back here. And if we identify this problem out here that's 6 months away, now we have plenty of time to deal with this. Okay, so we get out here and we say, well, we get down here to, this is the contingency funding part of our cash flow. We have various funding options. I've just listed some. You may have others that you may choose to use. You may say, well, hey, if we're looking at this, we'll have a share sale. We'll raise our rates and have a CD sale, and that'll work. Or we'll raise our money market shares, and we'll do a segmentation strategy and raise some money. It doesn't matter how you solve this problem over here. It doesn't have to be one of these options. It can be any option that's viable for you. In this case, I said, we'll just choose to raise some broker CDs. A total of $3.1 million approximately. That's how we're going to do this. You could have done any of these things. You could have sold some of those mortgage backs if you choose to. You could have drawn on your secured and committed line of credit. You could have repoed those mortgage backs. Maybe you can early redeem some of the CDs. That may or may not be feasible. But you have all kinds of options. The whole goal of this exercise is to look at this out in front far enough that you have plenty of time to exercise your options and resolve those potential cash negative cash flows. Here's some general rules for cash flow forecasting. It's a macro analysis, so don't try and make it detailed. It's a macro analysis. The little things don't count. Don't worry about the details. Keep it as simple as possible. Use large components. Don't sweat the small stuff. I'm repeating myself here. The first 1 to 3 months is far more important than in reality. The first month is the most important. And then when in the end, we're going to want to stress test this this cash flow. There are two stress tests that with regard to cash flows that are pretty standard. There's many, but one of the stress tests, after we do this likely scenario, and the cash flow we just did is the likely scenario, the stress test would be an isolated event where your credit union is experiencing a liquidity event, but you're the only one. Everybody else in town or in your area is okay. For some reason, could be any one of a number of reasons, you're having a cash flow event. You might just have a outstanding lending demand. That would be a problem. I know some of you would sacrifice a body part for at this point in time. It might be that you have a reputation risk issue. It might be that your field of membership is on strike, or fields of membership, or maybe your only field of membership, closed down and just went out of business. And so you're having a cash flow event that nobody else is experiencing. And so all of your resources, your counterparties, are going to be able to perform. If you have a line of credit, they'll probably perform on that line of credit. If you want to repo securities, if you want whatever you want to do, your counterparty will probably be able to perform. The second type of event is a systemic event, where the banking system is collapsing and all of your counterparties and resources are struggling and you're on your own. Basically, your counterparties, your lines of credit are going to struggle to meet your needs. Or they may not meet your needs at all. Or they may just be going out of business too. Or they may have seen their examiners walk in and take control of the bank or the credit union or the facility, whoever it is. But the systemic event simply means that you pretty much have to solve your problem with your own resources. So basically, when we refer to stress testing, it could be any type of an event that you want to test, but the most common events for stress testing are the isolated event where you're the only institution or one of a few institutions that are having a problem, and a systemic event where the whole system is in trouble, similar to where we were in September of 2008, and you're basically on your own. Okay, so let's talk about very briefly about a liquidity risk policy. Every one of you that are federally insured is required to have a liquidity risk policy. So here's the components of a liquidity risk policy, and this is right in the regulation. I literally copied it right out of the regulation. A couple of the important points, let me just highlight a couple of important things. It has to define responsibilities. Some of you are really small. All the responsibility is going to be split up between the board and the CEO. Some of you may have a CFO or an ALCO or other staff members. But your policy should assign the responsibility for who's going to do what and when they're going to do it. Who's responsible for what? Who's responsible for actually estimating liquidity risk? Who's responsible for bringing that report to the board of directors and that type of information? Your policy should make provisions for how you're going to estimate liquidity risk. Are you just going to use those static balance sheet ratios? For those of you that are small and have really simple balance sheets, that probably will get you through the day. If you're larger or more complex, you probably are going to need to do some kind of cash flow forecasting. But whatever it is, it needs to be stated in your policy. Our credit union will use one-year cash flow forecast, and we're going to do that every quarter, and we're going to do that every quarter as often as necessary. And then what's going to happen? Are we going to report that to the board of directors? Are we going to report that to the ALCO? Where's that information going to go, and what are they going to do with it? And the last one is defined liquidity risk limits. For example, if you're talking about your static balance sheet ratios, maybe your loans to shares, your risk limit might be 90%. At the point where you get 90% loans to shares, that's as far as you want to go. Or it might be higher than that. I'm just throwing out examples here. I'm not making suggestions on your risk limits. It might be less than that. Could be pretty much wherever you want it, depending on your net worth, the nature of your balance sheet, the liquidity of your loans, and on all those variables that we spent the last 45 minutes talking about. So there's the bullets that your policy should cover. Obviously, if you're a a small, simple balance sheet, your policy can be pretty simple and pretty short. If you're a large, complex credit union, your policy obviously is going to be more extensive and more complex. We do have on our website a funding and liquidity risk template that you're welcome to use. It's free of charge and it's available to anyone. You don't have to be a client. It's downloadable in Word format. Please only use it as a guideline and adapt it to your specific needs. But we feel like it covers most of the points. It may be a little more complex than you need if you're a really small credit union. And if you're a large, complex credit union, you're probably going to have to add to it. But you're welcome to get onto our website and look at that policy and use it as appropriate. Now let's talk about a contingency funding plan. The contingency funding plan is specifically required in letter 10, CU 14. Contingency fund is obviously written and it's approved. Should consider all of the credit union's risk activities. And we say risk activities, we're talking about lending, your operations, your marketing. You need to be able to fund all of these things. What I didn't put down there was a deposit and share withdrawals, but that probably it would be covered here under your operations. So your contingency funding plan needs to be comprehensive and include the major components of the credit union's activities. It identifies events that would be triggers or warning signs. And we've talked about some of those. We talked about loans to shares. You may set a limit and say, well, at 90% or whatever limit you choose, loans to shares is going to be a trigger. If we go past loans to shares, that's going to trigger our contingency funding plan. Another one could be a uncorrected violation of your risk limits, whatever your risk limits are. If you're out of limit and it's significant and it's not getting corrected, that could be a trigger to trigger your contingency funding plan. If one of your counterparties, this is a little less likely, is downgraded, someone you're counting on for funding, that could be a condition that would trigger your contingency funding plan. For credit unions, that would be somewhat unlikely, but certainly could happen. Happened in the past with the corporate system. The contingency funding plan, or the CFP, should have an action plan for specific scenarios. Now, these are not detailed action plans. These are general action plans. What if your counterparty fails? What if the Federal Home Loan Bank that you had relied on as a major source of funding, for whatever reason, fails or notifies you that your line of credit is canceled? That you should have a plan for. If you have a reputation risk issue, and everybody does, you should have a plan. Well, what if our reputation risk comes up and bites us? What are we going to do? Natural disaster. Often the natural disaster is accompanied by a shortage of currency, of cash, in the immediate vicinity of the natural disaster. What are we going to do? How are we going to open? Are we going to try and open all of our branches, or are we going to concentrate everything on one branch? These types of things. You should have management assignments. Who's responsible for activating the plan? How are they going to communicate? Who are they going to report to? At what point do we notify the board of directors that we have activated our contingency funding plan? Have we tested our contingency funding plan? And obviously the plan needs to be reviewed and updated periodically. Now, the process of all this is not to plan for every possible contingency and every possible event. That's not possible. These are generalized plans, the process of which is to make you think. And coming out of the most recent liquidity crunch in 2008 and 2009, Those experienced risk managers who were impacted by liquidity risks say their actual plans were not as important as the experience gained in constructing the plan. So it's the process of thinking, of planning, where most of the value comes from. Yeah, you may have a plan for reputation risk. In reality, it may be a good plan or a bad plan, but in reality, if you activate that plan, it's not going to go the way you planned it. But having thought about it and thought it through and considered the possible outcomes is going to come back and be a very valuable experience for you. I've had a little bit of personal experience in this, and I can tell you that is in fact the case. Okay, let's sum it up. Liquidity risk is a measure of your ability to meet demands for your funding. For credit unions, mostly unanticipated share withdrawals. The potential for credit unions has increased in that their balance sheets are becoming more complex. At this moment in time, most of you have more short-term liquidity than you would like to have, and it's not a big deal. But look at your balance sheet and look at where it is and look at where you would like it to be. If your balance sheet gets to where you want it to be, is it more complex and have more liquidity risk than you thought about? And the answer to that question for at least a lot of you is yes, it would be. Concentration risk aggravates liquidity risk, and we in the letter one or letter 1014 formalizes that requirement. Let me get back there just a minute. Formalizes that requirement, and the letter from last year in 13 actually lays out the requirement for credit unions. All credit unions need a written liquidity risk policy. Credit unions over $50 million in assets need a written contingency funding plan. And if you happen to be over $250 million, you need to have access to the Fed window or the CLF. Thank you very much for attending, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for us to do this. This is our last webinar. We're going to take the summer regroup, hopefully come back to you in the fall, September, with some updated and timely webinars, some new and some that are updated to the current circumstances that we're dealing with out there. We may have an answer on the risk-based capital situation. We may not, but we'll take all that into account over the summer and be back with a new series of webinars in the fall. In the meantime, this webinar and all of our webinars are available on our website, and you can go and click on those and download and watch those at your convenience. There is no charge, no obligation for doing that. Okay, and we do liquidity risk analysis. If you have an interest in helping us or getting some help with your liquidity risk, there's the contact info. We'd love to talk to you. Thank you very much for attending. I haven't seen any questions pop up, but if you have a question, I'll keep this panel open for a few minutes and watch for that and respond to that if I see any questions show up there. Thank you again, and we'll see you all down the road a little bit. Bye-bye.